Up next, Dr. Michael Bell from the Centers for Disease Control talks about the agency's report on antibiotic resistance, which affects millions of Americans each year, and why the drugs may soon not be able to protect us from infection. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate.
WNYC support comes from Holy Name Medical Center's Regional Cancer Center in Teaneck, New Jersey, with access to a broad spectrum of services and equipped with advanced technology. 877-HOLY-NAME or holyname.org. Thompson Safaris, based in Boston and Tanzania, offering sustainable African safaris and Kilimanjaro treks for over 30 years. Our home, your adventure. More at thompsonsafaris.com. The Frick Collection, presenting David Danger, Making the Modern Monument, Celebrity Depictions of the 19th Century, the first U.S. exhibition on Danger, whose likenesses appeared in monuments, statuettes, and medals, and whom Victor Hugo called the Michelangelo of Paris, frick.org.
As a companion to the historic August Wilson's American Century Cycle Recording Project, the Green Space is presenting a series of talks that illuminate aspects of August Wilson's masterpiece. Join Terrence McKnight tonight for a conversation on how the themes of religion, spirituality, and Africa resonate through Wilson's plays. Find a schedule and tickets at wnyc.org/thegreenspace.
On the next Fresh Air, legal scholar Evan Mandery looks back to the 1970s when the Supreme Court appeared to have abolished the death penalty in the United States, but then, in a case 4 years later, reinstated it. He's the author of a new book called A Wild Justice, The Death and Resurrection of Capital Punishment in America. And that follows this show at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. Antibiotics have been seen as miracle drugs ever since penicillin was first used in the 1930s, but according to the Centers for Disease Control, their widespread usage nowadays may be making us sicker. Researchers say that about half of antibiotic use in the U.S. is unnecessary or inappropriate, and that's just one reason bacteria have been able to increasingly strengthen their defenses against the medicines that have been designed to fight them. It's also why some infectious disease experts are worried that we might soon return to a time when people will die from ordinary infections. This week, the CDC released a report on antibiotic resistance that quantifies just how bad the situation is and what we can do about it. Dr. Michael Bell is Deputy Director of the CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hi.
Thanks very much.
According to the study, every year more than 2 million people in the United States get infections that are resistant to antibiotics. How many people die from those infections, do we know?
We're talking about 23,000 deaths a year.
Is this the first time federal authorities have put a number on this problem?
Well, it's the first time we've brought all the different aspects of resistance together in one pot. So there's been attention through the years on specific pathogens, specific germs, and each one has tied to it that sort of data. This is the first report that paints a full picture across the board.
Were you surprised by what the data reveals?
I think we're impressed, yes. The magnitude is something that I think we've been aware of, as I said, in a piecemeal fashion. But it is truly impressive when you look at the contribution overall to death and illness in this country.
What does it mean to have these numbers now?
Well, I think it gives us fresh ammunition, frankly, to go to the public, to clinicians, to hospital systems, and continue to push for appropriate use of antibiotics. I think when we see numbers of this magnitude, it makes it much more compelling on a national level to push for action.
But we have known for a while now. I mean, I've been reading about the fact that there's overuse of antibiotics for years. And yet they continued to be prescribed. What do you have to do?
Yeah, the what do you have to do is certainly a big question. I can tell you the thing that's different now that makes this discussion a little bit more urgent, in fact, a lot more urgent, is that up until now, the pipeline of new drugs has always been a safe fallback. We've been always able to look at the next crop of new medications and say, even though we've used up these drugs, there's something new on the horizon. Now we're in a situation where, if we're optimistic, we've still got a 5 to 10 year gap before a new volley, if you will, of antibiotics is available. that makes for some lean times coming up if we don't preserve what we have left.
And then there's always the problem of the bacteria developing resistance to the new one, and so you got to come up with another one again.
Exactly. It's been that way since 1929, when penicillin hit the markets. With every single drug that's been developed, we've seen resistance evolve fairly quickly.
So people resistant to penicillin these days?
Not people, but bacteria. Mm-hmm. The loss of not only penicillin, but many of the primary antibiotics that we rely on is changing the ability that we have to deliver modern medical care. I think it's important to remember that, there's the untreatable infection itself that we're concerned about, but the ramification leads to the inability to do things that we take for granted, the inability to offer transplants, the inability to treat cancers. Anything that we do that reduces the body's immune system's ability to fight infection is backed up by the ability to treat those infections with an antibiotic. If you lose that, then the other procedures become much more difficult to do.
Now, I mentioned 2 million people getting infections that are resistant to antibiotics, and you pointed out that 23,000 of them die each year. What would the numbers look like had the CDC taken into account people for whom these diseases weren't the primary cause of death, even though they might have played a role in their failing health?
Oh, gosh. I won't speculate, but it would be much, much greater.
Now, because it can lower your immune system's efficiency?
Well, no. So what I'm referring to when I talk about limited immunity in terms of medical practices, if I receive a kidney transplant and I need to be on immunosuppressive drugs so that I don't reject my kidney, then I'm probably going to need antibiotics periodically if I get an infection. Similarly, if I receive radiation for a tumor, and my bone marrow is shut down by that, and I don't have my normal immune capabilities, then I need to have antibiotics at the ready in case I get a bloodstream infection or other severe infection. If there is no antibiotic, then the treatment for these other diseases becomes deadly.
But the things you're describing still tend to be fairly rare. Are we also seeing things that are more common, generally thought to be easy to fight, affected nowadays?
That's a great question. The common bladder infection. As a clinician, I'm accustomed to simply writing a prescription. When someone comes in with evidence of a bladder infection, that person goes and fills their prescription, takes a pill, goes back to work, and the impact on their lives is pretty minimal. For some of these bacteria, specifically I'm talking about carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, or CRE, these include things like E. coli, a very commonplace cause of bladder infections. And when we start to see essentially untreatable versions of E. coli coming out, if that leads to routine bladder infections, then the response isn't just a quick prescription. It means going into the hospital, getting IV antibiotics, and maybe not even being able to be treated. This is happening in other countries where medications like antibiotics are available over the counter without a prescription. We're seeing kids coming in from the community without relationship to being in a hospital with these very bad organisms causing bladder infections.
Isn't there one type of bacteria, is it called CRE or CRE?
Yes, CRE. Mm-hmm.
It has been resistant to nearly all antibiotics.
That's exactly true.
But it's pretty rare in the United States.
Well, it started out very small, and it's still infrequent, but we've now seen it in at least 44 states, so it is spreading.
Do you foresee a time when people could die from even the most common or routine illnesses?
Well, that's where we were back in the day. If you think back to the seriousness with which people reacted to a cut from farm work or an injury, that was because those wounds could lead to a life-threatening infection. If we lose the ability to treat those organisms, we could be back in that situation again.
And how far away do you think we might be from that?
I can't give you a concrete time limit, but I will say we're getting closer to the edge. The fact that, we're seeing that CRE, CRE-type organism, in 44 states means that it's not limited to one location or one facility. We are promoting the prevention of infections, of the tracking of antibiotic resistance and of the careful use of remaining antibiotics now, because we're concerned that if we wait much longer, we'll be much too close to that cliff.
If I'm just a regular reader of newspapers, have been aware of the fact that antibiotics have been prescribed way too often for years, why are doctors still prescribing them when they're unnecessary? What responsibility does the medical community have in slowing the progress of antibiotic resistance?
I think that's an excellent point. I think every clinician needs to ensure that they're using antibiotics correctly. You mentioned at the beginning of the segment that as much as half of antibiotics prescribed in this country are either unnecessary or inappropriate. We are promoting the use of best practices in terms of prescribing, ranging from automated computer systems that give clinicians a warning if their prescription doesn't make sense. We're looking at systematic ways of ensuring that there's a good rationale for using an antibiotic in the first place when it comes to prescribing in hospitals. We are promoting very strongly the idea of a double-check timeout at around 72 hours after starting an antibiotic in a hospital so we can step back and see if it's still necessary. At the same time, in the community, in outpatient settings, we are talking to clinicians and patients about whether it's really the smartest thing to do to insist on an antibiotic. If you don't really need one for the scratchy throat, it's better not to insist on an antibiotic and use other forms of care to feel better.
A listener who works at an oral hygienist office says 2,000 milligrams of antibiotics are routinely given after extractions, even without infection, and she wonders if that's okay.
Well, so there's an entire group of antibiotics that are used for prophylaxis. We use antibiotics immediately before and sometimes during a surgical procedure to reduce the risk of an infection after that procedure. And that is a good way of using antibiotics. The bad thing is if someone doesn't remember to stop the antibiotics after the prophylaxis.
A mother of three children who get more antibiotics than she ever did asks if there's a way to hold off giving kids antibiotics until it's known that the illness is serious.
So obviously any time you do need an antibiotic, we want children to get them promptly. But I think it's very worthwhile to have a conversation with your pediatrician or your nurse practitioner about your concern and possibly even reluctance to jump right into an antibiotic if you can take a more wait-and-watch type approach. The key, though, is to really watch, because you don't want to miss the opportunity to treat a bad infection.
I'm talking to Dr. Michael Bell, Deputy Director of the Centers for Disease Control's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. Isn't antibiotic resistance adding to medical costs?
It is. We are talking probably on the order of $20 to $30 billion a year.
Wow. Because now we have to find other ways to fight illnesses that were pretty easily treated in the past?
For a number of reasons. One, exactly as you say, we need to use often a more expensive drug. But also we know that people who have infections that are resistant to antibiotics spend a longer time in the hospital. Their outcomes are worse. They don't do as well. They don't get better as quickly. The rate of death is higher. And when you add all of that up together, it adds up very quickly to $20 to $30 billion.
The government has estimated that over 70% of the antibiotics used in the United States going to animals, especially the ones that we eat. Is that contributing to the problem?
Well, antibiotics anywhere will drive resistance. Organisms, when they're exposed to antibiotics, whether in our bodies or in a field, are going to gradually evolve towards resistance. And so we promote safe and appropriate antibiotic use regardless of the location.
Well, we do see people selling antibiotic-free meat. Is that the answer? Or just becoming a vegetarian?
Well, there isn't a simple, easy solution. I think that antibiotics are very important for treating illnesses in livestock and other animals. On the other hand, if we don't need to use them for those purposes, it's best not to.
A listener wonders about antibacterial soaps and hand washes.
So this is a common concern. I think that It's important to remember that the antibiotics that we take in order to cure an infection are different types of chemicals than the disinfectants that are in things like household cleaners, soaps, and so on. So those things don't directly drive antibiotic resistance at all. Is it possible for organisms to also become resistant to some of those disinfectants? It depends on the chemical. But if you take, for example, alcohol and an alcohol hand rub, organisms don't evolve to tolerate alcohol in the same way that they evolve to tolerate something like penicillin.
Now, a lot of people are allergic to penicillin. Have we seen an increase in allergic reactions?
Not that I'm aware of.
So it's the problem just is that penicillin has been less effective in many cases. We've had to find alternatives to it.
Exactly. That's correct.
A separate study in the journal JAMA, Internal Medicine, conducted by the researchers from Johns Hopkins, found that patients who lived near farms and areas where manure was dumped were 38% more likely to develop a MRSA infection. Might this imply that there is some connection between antibiotic use in farm animals and human infection?
Well, I suppose it's possible. I would have to look at the type of MRSA and see if there's a relationship, but it certainly is an intriguing possibility.
Well, MRSA is often spread in hospitals, isn't it?
It is, and in the community.
So why have these types of diseases become so common in hospitals, or have we been finding ways to fight them?
I think we're making some very good progress in terms of fighting the infections themselves. We've recently published a paper, for example, showing that if you routinely bathe patients in chlorhexidine on arrival to an intensive care unit, you can drop not only the MRSA, but a variety of other infections by a very large percentage. And this is a reasonably low-cost, high-effectiveness practice that can benefit patients across the board. We've also shown that if you follow the guidelines from CDC that tell you how you should use intravenous catheters and how you should put them in, you can drop the bloodstream infection rates related to those catheters by as much as 70%. So there are some very nice ways that we can reduce the actual number of infections. And our goal, frankly, is to eliminate them.
Well, there was a time when doctors didn't wash their hands. And then when they realized that if they washed their hands, they would cut down on infections, it became normal practice. Are these things becoming normal practice as well?
They are. So the challenge, just like with hand washing, is to do it right every single time. And that consistency is something that we work very closely with hospital associations and health departments, in addition to hospitals, to promote and support long term.
Your study finds that the loss of effective antibiotic treatments will also have an effect on patients who suffer from other types of illnesses, for instance, people with cancer or people who need joint or organ replacements. Now, you mentioned what's going to happen with organ replacements, but are doctors in these various fields aware of what's going on?
They are, but I think, in fairness, many of them are focused on, for example, treating the cancer that they're dealing with on behalf of their patient. And the thought about, will treating this particular infection with this drug lead to resistance for the rest of the country, is probably not at the top of their list.
Is there a limit to how many different antibiotics we can develop? Because what I imagine what we do is we just tweak the one that is no longer as effective as it used to be, and then hope that the new one will be more effective for a time.
Yes, so that is a pattern that we've seen through the years. And I can tell you there is a limit to what we can develop in the next several years. It's looking, as I said, fairly dry. On the other hand, there are some promising things on the horizon. I think that it's going to be a combination approach. I think the days of simply relying on a new antibiotic are probably over, and we need to realize that if we do the same things that we've done through the years with a new set of antibiotics, we'll be back where we are today in a matter of years.
When someone shows up in a hospital, let's say, and doesn't respond to antibiotic treatment, what are the physicians on staff able to do?
Well, so first and foremost, we look at the laboratory data to make sure that there isn't an alternative antibiotic that we can attempt to use. If that's not the case, then supportive care for an infection might be enough to help you survive that infection and get better, but it might not be.
The CDC did something different with this study. For the first time, it ranked the threat of antibiotic-resistant germs on a scale of urgent to concerning. Will these rankings help prioritize any actions that the CDC might take to combat these infections?
Not only at the CDC, but I think across the medical and science community, there's a need to focus on the urgent threats. These are threats for which we don't have other antibiotics to fall back on, threats which are transmitted easily from one person to another, and which cause significant disease. And, you know, in that category, we've listed CRE, the carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae that we've spoken about, as well as drug-resistant gonorrhea. And a third organism which, even though it's not actually resistant per se, is strongly tied to overuse of antibiotics. That's Clostridium difficile, or C. diff. That causes about 250,000 hospitalizations a year and about 14,000 deaths.
It has a diarrheal infection associated with its use, doesn't it?
It does, but it's more than just the antibiotic-related diarrhea. Unfortunately, in many cases, because of the toxins that are produced by this bacterium, the colon becomes so badly damaged that it actually has to be surgically removed.
Are there any other ways to treat C. diff?
Well, C. diff generally responds to certain antibiotics given by mouth, and so it can be treated. The problem is it tends to occur in situations where an individual has already received a great deal of other antibiotics. It's almost like a squatter in the intestinal tract, where if there's a vacancy created by other antibiotics, these organisms can take hold and start generating an infection and toxins that damage the colon.
Haven't I read that one way of treating C. diff has been fecal transplants, which sounds to me like something counterintuitive?
Well, you know, if you think about the squatter image, if you can repopulate that colon with healthy bacteria, then it makes it less hospitable to the Clostridium.
So, me as a patient, what can I do to slow the progression of antibiotic resistance? Do I just simply tell the doctor who says, well, you have an infection, I'm going to give you an antibiotic that'll get rid of it? Do I say, no, I don't want to take it?
If you need an antibiotic, you should take the antibiotic. But you should take the whole prescription. One thing that is not all that unusual is to take just a third or half of the prescription until you start to feel better. And what that does is gives the antibiotic an opportunity to kill most of the bacteria, but leaving enough of the ones that were somewhat tougher that they can start regenerating. If you do that, you can actually create a resistant infection with partial treatment like that. This is very common with diseases like tuberculosis that need to be treated for a long period of time. So taking your entire prescription as written is one thing you can do, and that's the other end of the spectrum from not insisting on antibiotics if your clinician says you probably don't need them.
Now, we've seen antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis popping up. How is it being treated?
So there are fourth and fifth line drugs that can be used to treat tuberculosis, but they are very difficult to take. They have a lot of side effects. Some of them are only available through injection, and they're quite painful to receive. So the goal really is to appropriately and completely treat tuberculosis infections so that the first line drugs can do their work.
Are pharmaceutical companies researching antibiotic resistance?
Yes. Yes. Many of the producers of antibiotics are investing a great deal of effort in finding that next generation of product.
And what other kind of research do you think needs to be done?
Well, you know, CDC is currently investing a great deal in advanced molecular diagnostics using the entire genome sequencing capabilities and the sort of bioinformatic analysis thereafter to get a much more refined look at the fingerprinting that we do to track the movement of some of these organisms, we're able to identify where the organisms are actually being transmitted, finding hot spots that we can address specifically with targeted resources and targeted measures. And so that kind of technologic improvement is one advance that we're looking at.
Dr. Michael Bell is Deputy Director of the Centers for Disease Control's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. We've been talking about a really shocking report from the CDC. Thank you so much for being on our show.
You're most welcome.